Yet here she was, with her assumptions, driving the policy of California. The computer model gave the governor little choice but to shut down the entire state and take responsibility for what should have been a national decision, because neither the Centers for Disease Control nor the President of the United States had the nerve to make it. Carter's emails should be framed as a national monument, said Charity. They drove decisions in California. And not just in California. The two other states that moved most quickly to shut down, Ohio and Maryland, had also paid close attention to Carter's analysis. The question was what to do next. You could keep people from moving around for only so long before they'd resume moving around. Park turned to Charity and said, "Go lock yourself in a room and write a plan for California." And she did. But there was a new problem. As late as mid-February, it might have made sense to write a plan for California. Indeed, though no one had asked her to do it, she'd as good as written one in her head. She would have reverse-cordoned the entire state the way Singapore had done. She'd have tried to sell the governor on holding the line until April, when other states would be burning up with virus, and everyone would see the wisdom of California's actions. She had her list of things she would have done to contain the virus, but those only worked before the virus was widespread. "I wrote a plan for California," she said, when she emerged from the room. "But I can't write a plan for California. It has to be for the whole country. It doesn't matter what California does if other states don't do it too." To which Todd Park replied, "Okay, write a plan for the entire country. We can just call all the other governors." And so she returned to the room and, with some help from Bob Kocher, wrote a plan for the entire country and handed it to Todd Park, with the understanding that they keep her authorship a secret. If her bosses found out she'd written it, she'd be fired. The national plan ran to several pages and had three big features. The first was for the president to announce a stay-at-home order for the entire country until it was able to test as much as was needed. As he did this, he would explain the second feature, the rules for reopening. Each community would receive one of three designations, hot, warm, cool, based on a few simple metrics: the number of cases per capita, the percentage of its COVID-19 tests that came in positive, the percentage of its hospital beds that were occupied. A community that was cool and more or less virus-free could live with few restrictions. A community that was hot with virus lived under a stay-at-home order. A community that was warm, it had virus circulating but reproducing at slower rates, could relax some of its rules. It could have weddings and funerals, for instance, and open public transport. These restrictions could be scaled up or down based on the heat of the community at any given time, she wrote. She realized that all this would need to be displayed on a dashboard so that people could check the status of their zip code every day. She picked red, yellow, and green to represent hot, warm, and cold, then had second thoughts. "That looks dumb. It's just the colors of a stoplight." But the modeling team thought it was great. The simpler and more familiar, the better. Later, she changed it from the three colors to eight, each with its own menu of social interventions, all inspired by the plan written years ago by Richard Hatchett and Carter Mesher. But the basic idea remained the same. As scientists learned more about the virus, the government would update the social interventions so that they remained as potent and as targeted as possible. If it emerged, for example, that children could not be made seriously ill by the virus or spread the virus to others, there might never be a reason to close schools. Her most curious idea, given how she had gone about her job as a local public health officer, was how she hoped for the plan to be enforced. She didn't want it to depend upon the bravery of some local public health officer. "What I really wanted was for it not to be enforced," said Charity. "I wanted it to say, 'We're not going to come rescue you. you are going to rescue yourselves. The local dashboards would allow everyone to see who in their neighborhood had been infected, who had gone to the hospital for it, and who had died. It's radical accountability, said Charity. Government has a role, but its role is to empower the grassroots by giving them data. If clusters of illness occurred, genomic sequencing would reveal how that had happened and who was responsible. As Charity sometimes put it, you know who farted in the crowded room. The president would need to issue an executive order to make an exception for medical privacy laws, but that seemed a small price to pay for a million American lives. Highly specific personal data would leave no room for people in any neighborhood to retreat into a private reality in which they could imagine that the virus either didn't exist or was overblown. You have to bring the carnage in front of people's faces for them to see it, said Charity. If some areas of the country need to hit bottom, so be it. The virus would enforce the plan. If the citizens in certain zip codes still insisted on some fiction, the virus would expose the lie, and they would soon find themselves isolated and unwelcome in other parts of the country, where businesses had reopened and a semblance of ordinary daily life had resumed. It wasn't just the effects of the virus that needed to be mitigated. The effects of the culture did too. For the plan to work, Charity thought, it needed to be locally controlled. Each zip code would be able to see what it needed to do if it wanted to relax restrictions. And each zip code would have its own leaders, who would know the best ways to encourage good behavior. The one shot America had at behaving well and thus saving itself was to remove the feeling that the government was imposing restrictions on people and reinstill the idea that people were imposing order on themselves to fight a common enemy. This is a call for all Americans to rise collectively in the spirit of patriotism with the same vigor and stubborn resolve that our grandparents' generation rose to meet the moment of WW2, she wrote, toward the end of the plan. But the spirit of the thing could be found right at the top, in the title she'd first scribbled on it, the Churchill Plan. Then Todd was like, "You can't name it that," she said. She wound up giving it a wonky title. Everyone owns their own or not. Everyone is responsible for the rate at which the virus reproduces in their own community. A few days after Charity handed over the plan, Todd Park and DJ Patil seemed to have gotten it into the hands of people who might actually take action. First, she had a call from a senior executive at Google, who said that Google could create the dashboards for every zip code in the country. Then a member of Todd's team approached her. He said, "Andy Slavitt is interested in your plan," recalled Charity. I said, "Who is Andy Slavitt?" Andy Slavitt turned out to be a former banker and consultant who ran Medicare and Medicaid under Obama a few years after Don Berwick left. Andy Slavitt was also, oddly enough, speaking every so often to Jared Kushner, the son-in-law of the president and a member of the new COVID supply chain group within the coronavirus task force. Andy Slavitt himself emailed Charity, asking if she wanted to edit her plan, which she had typed up, simplified a bit, and added some stuff to, about who in government might be assigned to perform its various tasks. What he'd done struck Charity as mostly inconsequential and inoffensive, until she got to the place where Slavitt had taken it upon himself to write the CDC into the plan, to define standards by which a community is designated hot, warm, or cold. "No," wrote Charity in a comment. "The single most important part of this plan is it is not run by the CDC. It is run and overseen by an entity with actual experience in frontline warfare in outbreaks." She stressed her feelings in the email she sent back to Slavitt, along with her edits. "Very important point," she wrote. "Who is operationalizing, leading this plan? The entity, agency, figurehead leading this must be a Churchill, not a Chamberlain." Then she thought, what the hell? And sat down and wrote talking points for the President of the United States and sent them along too. After that, there was nothing to do but wait and see if her bosses fired her for insubordination. After all, she worked for the state of California and its Democratic governor, and she was moonlighting as a policy advisor to the Republican President of the United States. She never heard from Andy Slavitt again. Slavitt renamed the plan Victory Over COVID-19 and presented it to Kushner as his own. But a few days later, the Google executive called her to say, Jarrett loved your plan and is briefing POTUS on it. What freaked us out, recalled DJ Patil, was when this memo came out of the White House with the same language that was in the plan. He sent it to Charity with a note. Now you know you've made a difference. But she didn't. Not really. It was just a leaked memo, not a commitment from the president to a new national strategy. And so she waited. If you had asked her just then what she was waiting for, she would have told you that, in the best case, she was waiting to hear her plan for the country rolled out by the president. Which is to say that as late as the end of March 2020, she still had hope. And as she waited, her governor, in whom she still had faith, did the sort of thing that might have given her even more of it. He called the red phone. Part 3. 10. The bug in the system. The red phone had always been a less than perfectly efficient tool for saving lives. Joe DeRisi was the first to admit that. Most people whose lives needed saving never knew of its existence, and even those lucky enough to find out about it often called it too late. They wound up like the Chinese woman with Balamuthia, whose doctors hadn't thought to look for a brain-eating amoeba until they'd spent $1,100,000 on ineffective treatments, and the amoeba had consumed most of her brain. The red phone could leave both its callers and its owner upset, and yet, even at its most frustrating, it enlightened. It showed you what you had missed, so that you were less likely to miss it the next time. It could also reveal big systemic problems. After all, if you were calling the red phone, it was usually because some system had failed you. One evening in March, Joe looked down, saw an unfamiliar number, and very nearly didn't answer it. The area code was Sacramento, his hometown, and so he gave the caller the benefit of the doubt. I thought it was a telemarketer, but I picked it up and it was Gavin Newsom. The California governor explained that he had a problem but was still unsure of its dimensions. He asked Joe to make two lists. One, of the three best things the governor of California might do to respond to the new coronavirus. The other, of the three worst. I said, number one was testing, recalled Joe, because if there is no testing, there isn't even the possibility of a solution. Testing was the only way to find the virus and to predict its movements. Testing was so important, Joe told Newsom, that there wasn't much point in worrying about the other items on either list. The public health system was failing California's governor, as it was failing the governor of every other state. The CDC's second attempt to create a test for COVID-19 that might be mass-produced and distributed to public health officers across the country hadn't turned out any better than its first. The absence of federal leadership, combined with the fragmented nature of the American healthcare system, meant that tests for the virus either weren't available or were being processed too slowly to be of any use. Joe read stories of people waiting 10 days for test results from LabCorp and Quest Diagnostics, two of the country's biggest private labs. Sending tests, even to the CDC, was taking days, not hours, said Joe. A test that took 10 days to process was a pointless test. Absent fast tests, hospitals were being forced to treat everyone who rolled into the parking lot with coronavirus-like symptoms as if they had the virus, when more often than not, they did not. Beds in the coronavirus wing were being taken by people who didn't need them. Nurses and doctors were running through scarce protective gear they needed for actual coronavirus patients. But the biggest problem of having no tests was not knowing where the virus was and where it was not. Without fast tests, you could not isolate the people who needed to be isolated or liberate the people who didn't. Gavin Newsom had no plan to create a lot of testing in California. Why would he? Like everyone else, the governor had assumed the federal government would make sure that the country had enough testing to track any new virus. Joe could see that the CDC wasn't going to solve the problem, but there was a solution. The United States was by far the world's leader in microbiology research. It contained thousands of microbiology labs run by private companies and universities and nonprofits, like the one he presided over at the Chan Zuckerberg Biohub. The thing to do, Joe decided, was to transform the Biohub into a COVID-19 testing center as quickly as possible and publish a paper to show others how to do it. Governor Newsom agreed to issue an executive order to allow people to work in a clinical lab who were not certified to do it. "We were afraid we were going to get our asses sued," said Joe. And the Biohub put out an APB for volunteers. What happened next would have astonished lots of people, but not Joe. A small army of graduate students and postdocs, mostly from UCSF, rushed to help. "They came in droves," said Joe. And it was always, "How can I help? How do I do this?" No one asked to be paid. They'd been born and raised basically everywhere. China, Taiwan, Colorado, Tanzania, Lithuania, Florida, Canada, Phoenix, Belgium. The Americans answered with a city or state, and the non-Americans with a country. When you asked them where they were from, all were research scientists, many with PhDs. Precisely zero ever had done the jobs they were about to do. Yet within days, they were trained and ready. They organized themselves into squads to be kept separate from each other, so that if one person contracted the virus, it would incapacitate only one squad and not the entire army. Each squad had its hierarchy, and each person learned the job of the person immediately above him, so that he could replace him if necessary. "We built in battlefield promotions," said Joe. It was different from a regular research lab, where people just do what they want and come and go as they please. It was more like a factory, a production line. The line was organized into stations, each staffed by someone willing to work long hours without pay. "I used to have these terror dreams, that we'd have 100 people need a cocktail at the same time for happy hour," said one of the postdocs, who had once worked as a bartender. "Now I have the same dream about thousands of people needing test results at once." In a single room the size of a basketball court, a COVID testing lab took shape. Setting it up gave Joe his first real view of the medical industrial complex. It wasn't designed for a crisis. If it was designed for anything, it was to maximize the profits of companies that enjoyed monopoly power. LabCorp and Quest, which were charging the state $160 for every COVID test and returning the results so slowly that they were useless, were just one example. The companies that made the testing machines were another. The fancy so-called sample-to-answer machines had one big advantage. They were idiot-proof. Any low-paid lab technician could insert a patient's test tube into a slot, push a button, and wait for the machine to spit out a result. Yes, you had some virus, or no, you did not. The machines minimized the risk of error and lawsuits, but were ill-suited to a crisis. If anything went wrong inside them, you needed the manufacturer to sort it out, as you couldn't just open them and fiddle with them. To run at all, they required expensive chemicals made only by their manufacturers, and so shared the same infuriating quality as razors and office printers. Worse, the chemicals required to identify any one pathogen were specific to the pathogen. If you wanted to test for HIV, you needed to buy the chemicals capable of identifying HIV. To test for hepatitis C, you needed the hepatitis C brew. If you wanted to hunt willy-nilly for a virus, you could spend a fortune just on razor blades. In March 2020, there were still no chemicals to test for the coronavirus. The UCSF labs were littered with these sample-to-answer machines that couldn't be used. One machine was called the Panther, which Joe loved. "They all have these really cool names," he said. "The Panther. The Panther right now is asleep." The Panther would remain in hibernation right through the first months of the pandemic as the company that made it scrambled to make the materials required to run it. A weird black market would arise in the stuff you needed to wake the Panther up. Joe had a photo of a guy selling Panther equipment out of the back of his car. "Here is the frightening aspect of the global supply chain," said Joe. "When there is a surge in demand, inventory goes to zero. Just-in-time manufacturing. Great concept, horrible in a pandemic." Microbiology labs across America all had the same frustration. Fancy razors with no razor blades. Joe knew enough about the sample-to-answer testing machines to know they'd be a constraint. He needed a bunch of stuff fast and called UCSF's chancellor, Sam Hallgood, to discuss how to get it. "Every time I talk to Joe, he's got some new idea," said Hallgood, an Australian who had made a career managing Americans. "Coming from someone else, I'd say, gee, I need to check that out. But because it's Joe, I don't." With Hallgood's blessing, Joe and his team ransacked the university's labs for chemicals and liquid handling robots and testing machines that were far less idiot-proof but capable of detecting COVID-19. They grabbed spare parts and built machines themselves. On a rainy evening in mid-March, Joe could be found alone on the streets of San Francisco, wheeling some cart bearing a purloined machine. These machines also needed special chemicals to analyze samples, and the market for these chemicals had tightened. But, as with the machines themselves, the market for them was more resilient in a crisis. Here Joe learned, or perhaps relearned, another lesson about the private sector. As a Stanford graduate student, he had seen previously open and collaborative colleagues clam up the moment some venture capitalist threw money at them. "One day you come to work and their office shades would be down," he said. Over and over again, he saw the wild inefficiency of the private sector as a creator of knowledge. Far more often than not, some promising avenue of research would die as a failed company. He hated that. He hated the way financial ambition interfered with science and progress. As a pathogen threatened to overrun the United States and shut down its economy, he detected an odor he distinctly did not like coming off the private sector. One company was the biggest supplier of an enzyme they needed to run tests. "We called and told them what we were doing, and that we wanted to buy $1 million worth of this stuff," said Joe. "When you buy that quantity, you always get a discount. But they said, nope, you're paying full price." He was so pissed off that he looked around and found a smaller company, New England Biolabs, that sold the same enzyme. "Completely different spirit," said Joe. They said, "This is amazing. 40% discount right now." That's how companies should behave. It went that way with much of what they needed to buy. Some companies sought to exploit the moment. Others sought to help. We quickly figured out that some companies actually have a moral compass and some of them don't, said Joe. On March 18th, just 8 days after the idea was born, the Chan Zuckerberg BioHub's new COVID lab opened for business. It had taken Joe's new team 2 days less to build an entire lab than it was then taking Quest Diagnostics and LabCorp to process a single test. The new lab's 200 or so overqualified young research scientists were able to process 2,666 tests a day, as accurately as any lab in the country. They'd demonstrated their accuracy by taking samples that had already been processed in a smaller but highly accurate lab at UCSF and retesting them. They'd be able to return results to people within a day. In a pinch, they could get you an answer in 3 hours. And here was the kicker. They worked for free. There was no bill. You just handed over your test tubes with the nasal swab inside, and the BioHub told you who had COVID-19 and who did not. Joe assumed, not unreasonably, that his new team of volunteers would soon be overrun by hordes of customers delighted by the freebie. The previous week, the entire state of California had received fewer than 2,000 COVID-19 test results. Test tubes holding nasal swabs from more than 55,000 Californians were lying around in labs waiting to be evaluated. By redirecting 2,666 a day from the big corporate labs, the state of California could save itself $426,560 every day and get results back in time to make a difference. But they were not overrun by customers. The first few weeks, samples trickled in almost painfully at a rate of a couple hundred a day. And so Joe started calling around, to local hospitals, for example. The private chain of hospitals run by Kaiser Permanente said they wanted to set up their own not-free testing lab at some point, and, in the meantime, they'd continue to ship their samples to the big, slow, expensive private testing companies. Joe soon learned that private U.S. hospitals were either contractually obliged or habitually inclined to send tests to the for-profit labs, and that the for-profit labs had no incentive to move any faster than they were moving, as they got paid either way. The public health care centers, the clinics run by local departments of public health, presented a different problem. They were too busy to answer their phones. A team at the BioHub sent letters to local health officers in each of California's 58 counties. Free COVID testing. Inside of 24 hours. Still no response. Priscilla Chan herself hosted a call with the health directors of every California county and asked point blank, "Why are you not sending samples? It's free." A few more samples turned up, but nothing like as many as they could process. Joe couldn't figure it out. We were asking ourselves, is it a trust issue? Is it the Zuckerberg name? But it turned out that no one cared about any of that. It took a month or so for them to understand why a country so desperate for tests was so slow to accept an offer of free ones. One clue came during a phone call between the Chan Zuckerberg BioHub and the recently renamed Zuckerberg San Francisco General Hospital. If there was a place where the Zuckerberg name would help rather than hurt, this was it. "How much is it going to cost?" asked the woman at Zuckerberg General, after the team at Chan Zuckerberg had explained their new COVID-19 testing lab. "It's free," said the Chan Zuckerberg person. There was this super long pause, said Joe, who was on the line. "We don't know how to do no cost," said Zuckerberg. "What do you mean?" asked Chan Zuckerberg. "It shows up as an error in the hospital computer if we put zero cost," said Zuckerberg. "It won't accept zero."
"Can't you put like 1/10 of a cent?" asked Joe.
They couldn't. The system wouldn't allow it.
It was Balamuthia all over again. The cure meant nothing if the patient never received it. Standing between the cure and the patient in this case was a U.S. medical industrial complex that lurched between lethargy and avarice. Joe had never really had to understand its inner workings. Now he began to see that the incentives of virtually everyone in it were screwed up. To do something as simple as accept an offer of free coronavirus testing required either unusual effort or real courage. In San Quentin, they'd needed both. Early on, Joe had called officials at the famous prison to say, "You are a sitting duck. If the virus gets in there, people are going to die." The San Quentin officials sent in one batch of samples in April, but asked the biohub to keep mum about it because they were worried that the private testing company that serviced California prisons would be upset. "If Quest finds out, they're going to kill our contract," they'd said. That first batch contained no positives for COVID-19, but San Quentin sent no further samples. Later, they explained that they didn't have the time to do the paperwork. "I was stunned," said Joe. In late May, a busload of prisoners was moved to San Quentin from a prison in Chino where a COVID outbreak had occurred, and the warden had decided to thin the population. The Chino prisoners were tested a few days before they left, but not when they arrived in San Quentin. At least one of them showed up carrying the virus, and it proceeded to sweep through San Quentin and infect more than 1,000 men. 28 of them died. But the biggest reason that the biohub's free testing service went underused was the scarcity of test kits. Actually, that's not quite right. If at any point in the first few months of the pandemic, you rolled into a hospital parking lot with a dry cough and a fever and asked to be tested and the nurses said, "Sorry, we have no testing kits," what they likely meant was, "We have no nasal swabs." The long translucent sticks that could be inserted deep into the nasal passage and which offered the only reliable method to sample the virus at the start of the pandemic were nowhere to be found. The biohub looked into it and found that, outside of China anyway, just two factories made them. One was in Maine, the other in northern Italy. Neither had any for sale. That was the only time they turned to the federal government for help. The Department of Health and Human Services managed something called the Strategic National Stockpile. The precise contents of the $7 billion stash of medicines and supplies were meant to be a secret. People who had seen it, Carter Mesher, for instance, thought it looked like the giant warehouse in the final scene of Raiders of the Lost Ark. The stockpile offered the solution to the stress in supply chains that was bound to occur when every country on Earth suddenly wanted to buy the same medical supplies. It was the government's attempt to compensate for the limits and weaknesses of private markets. On March 13th, a biohub epidemiologist named Patrick Iescu wrote to the HHS guy responsible for California and explained that he was sitting in what was now the fastest big COVID testing lab in California, and maybe even, at that moment, the entire country. But they needed test kits, and especially nasal swabs. He asked for 40,000 swabs, which he reckoned was a 2-week supply. The HHS guy, Lucas Simpson, not his real name, was totally helpful. He called his superiors in Washington, who called the people in the White House who were meant to be managing medical supplies. "I will have to ask about the extraction kits," he wrote to the biohub on March 15th, referring to another scarce item. "But the swabs are a definite yes." The excitement in and around the biohub was palpable. The replies to Lucas Simpson flooded in. "Fantastic, Lucas. Lucas, you are my new best friend. You literally saved hundreds of lives." Lucas wrote back to ask for a delivery address. The truck was leaving a warehouse a 2-day drive away. and it contained not 40,000, but 100,000 swabs. Thanks, Lucas. You are literally a lifesaver. Lucas, if you have kids, tell them their daddy is a fucking hero. The next day, at a White House press conference, President Trump delivered a message to America's governors. Respirators, ventilators, all of the equipment, try getting it yourselves, he said, before setting out on Twitter to badger individual governors who had complained about the lack of federal leadership. Even then, the truck with the nasal swabs was rolling toward Sacramento. The mood in the biohub was Christmas Eve. Never in the unwritten history of nasal swabs had nasal swabs been awaited with such anticipation. On March 18th, the day the truck was scheduled to arrive, the mood changed. Suddenly, no one knew where the truck had gone, said Joe. It wasn't until 3 days later that Lucas Simpson called to say that the truck had been located in West Sacramento, but without swabs. What he didn't say, because he was too embarrassed to say it, was that inside the truck, they'd discovered not medical swabs, but Q-tips. So far as he could tell, there had never been any swabs in the Strategic National Stockpile. The pattern continued right through the pandemic. The Trump administration would claim with fanfare that supplies were on their way to the states and leave it to the career civil servants, whose job was to interact with state officials, to reap the humiliation when those supplies failed to arrive. It would happen again with ventilators, with the drug remdesivir, and finally with vaccines. Among other consequences of the White House's strategy was that it gutted the credibility of the career federal officials. After that, Joe became cynical about the federal government and started to say things like, "You're not actually supposed to know what's in the Strategic National Stockpile, probably because it doesn't have the shit you need." By early April, he was telling any reporter who called and any plausible-looking person he met about his need for nasal swabs. "It's the one thing if I could go back in time and change, I would," he said. "I wish I had bought 100,000 swabs. It was not on my radar. It was not a thing I thought would be the limiting factor in life." All sorts of people tried to help. A big shot venture capitalist, for instance, called Joe one day and said he had solved the problem. "I know a guy who has some swabs," he said. Joe was dubious. I said, "Really, you know a guy? Prove it." The VC said that his friend would overnight 5,000 swabs directly to Joe. And so the next day, Joe went to a UPS facility and indeed found waiting for him a large box labeled as medical supplies. "I pop open the box and there's 5,000 of something in there," said Joe. "They clearly didn't just fall off the back of a truck, and they kind of looked like swabs. But they weren't sterile or even packaged, so right there he knew they weren't medical supplies of any kind." Joe studied them until the penny dropped. Eyelash brushes. Some crafty soul had bought eyelash brushes, relabeled them as medical swabs, and sold them to the VC at a profit. The absence of federal leadership had triggered a wild free-for-all in the market for pandemic supplies. In this market, Americans vied with Americans for stuff made mainly by the Chinese. Mark Benioff, the CEO of Salesforce, flew in a plane load of materials from China to the UCSF Medical Center with boxes of functional, though less than ideal, nasal swabs on board. The owner of a Bay Area chemical company, Chris Kawaja, found another off-brand Chinese nasal swab supplier and messaged them. I said, "Hey, do you have these things?" Kawaja recalled. And this woman came right back and said, "Yeah, I have 250,000. These swabs were the real deal, but before Kawaja could nab them, the woman at the Chinese supplier sent another message to say, Some guy in Houston just took 200,000 of them. Khawaja charged the rest to his credit card. At 70 cents a pop, triple the old market price, and had them shipped to the Chan Zuckerberg biohub in small batches to bypass Chinese customs officials. It did occur to me, why did I need to find this stuff? Said Khawaja. Why did some random dude in Marin need to read some random newspaper article about how Joe DeRisi needed swabs and go and find the swabs? In the end, they found what they needed. By early April, the biohub was able not only to run 2,666 coronavirus tests a day, but to supply test kits to anyone who needed them. Late each night, lines of PhDs formed on the basketball court to assemble the kits for the resource-starved departments of public health. Joe had never seen the U.S. public health system from the inside. He knew there were these people called local public health officers, but he didn't really know what they did or have any sense of the conditions in which they worked. Once his team began to deliver free test kits to them, he understood why they'd been slow to take up the biohub's offer of free testing. Many local health officers were so understaffed and under-equipped that they had trouble using the test kits. Most were unable to receive the results electronically. They needed the results faxed to them. Some had fax machines so old that they couldn't receive more than 6 pages at a time. A few didn't even have functioning fax machines, and so the biohub got into the business of buying and delivering fax machines along with test kits. The members of the 4-person team Joe assembled at the biohub to help local public health officers hunt the new virus didn't know any more than Joe did about the U.S. public health system. They were just creative people who had wound up in a curious situation and were learning how America functioned, or didn't, as they went along. Josh Batson was a case in point. He'd done his PhD in mathematics at MIT without really knowing what he wanted to use math for, and never imagined that he'd wind up using it in biology or healthcare. But then a close friend of his from college dropped dead suddenly from a mysterious encephalitis. And not long after that, Josh was introduced to Joe, who knew all about solving encephalitis mysteries. It was right when the biohub was founded, recalled Josh, and I was like, that's what I want to do. Joe wanted Josh to use his math skills to create a kind of search engine to scour the biohub's new global virus detection network for viruses engineered in labs as bioweapons. The pandemic intervened, and Josh instead found himself trying to save Americans from their public health system. At the start, he had imagined that U.S. public health would be ready and waiting for the sophisticated tools he'd helped to create. He'd analyze genomic data, show health officers how the virus was moving in their communities, and, with the health officers in the lead, they'd go to battle. Instead, no one seemed to want to hear what he had to say. By late April 2020, he felt as if he had run into a battle that lacked any commanders at all. You rush in and you're like, okay, what can I do? He said, and there's no one to tell you what to do because everyone is up to their eyeballs. We had to become shadow public health officers. Another member of Joe's small public health team, David Dinnerman, also a mathematician, arrived with a different perspective. He'd been born in Poland and moved to the United States as a child. He had memories of Poland as a communist regime and of the total breakdown of the government's ability to be useful to its citizens. What he saw in the local U.S. public health offices reminded him of public services in Poland, but before the collapse of communism. Poland now is not like this, said David, after seeing the inside of a U.S. public health office. Poland now is more functional. Eastern Europeans are tough and kind of not shocked by a failed state. but these are the symptoms of a failed state. The drama began, as it often did, with a call from a public health nurse. She wanted to let Charity Dean know that a young man in Santa Maria, at the poor end of Santa Barbara County, had been discovered with 4+ tuberculosis in his lungs. The county health lab assigned a grade to each case based on how many tuberculosis bacteria they could count on the slide. 4+ meant that the slide was so thick with bugs that they'd stopped counting them. To get to 4+, you went first through all the other stages, and so the man likely had been infectious for months. He lived in a tiny house in a poor neighborhood, occupied by an ever-changing number of migrants from the Mexican state of Oaxaca. At that moment, in early 2013, when Charity was just a year or so into her new career as a public health officer, the house contained 18 members of an extended family named Zeferino, 6 adults and 12 children. Then she heard the young man's name, Agustin Zeferino. She was floored. His TB had been identified 9 months earlier by nurses at the Santa Maria Healthcare Center. His case stuck in Charity's mind in part because it had been one of her first, but also because his TB was a type resistant to one of the drugs, and so he'd required an extra pill. She'd confined him to a motel room for a couple of months until tests showed that he was no longer infectious, and then set him free. By now, Charity had made herself expert in the treatment of run-of-the-mill tuberculosis. She had seen cases where patients tested positive for the TB bacteria a few months into their treatment. But that happened rarely, and the bugs they found were usually dead. Agustin had been in treatment for 9 months. Charity had never heard of someone completing the treatment and remaining not just infected, but wildly infectious. I said, "No way it's his sputum. Someone else spit in the cup." Why Agustin would hand the nurse someone else's spit, she couldn't imagine. He'd been caught and jailed for selling drugs, was himself an addict, and so, in her mind, capable of anything. She did that sometimes, solved the crime without pausing to identify the motive. She called the nurse in Santa Maria and asked her to visit the Zeferino home and make all 18 of the people inside spit in a cup and watch them as they did it. I thought, someone else in that household is 4+, said Charity. When the results came back, her heart dropped. Agustin Zeferino himself indeed had 4+ TB. She had no idea what strange microbiological event had occurred inside the man, and only the faintest clue what to do about it. She had two options: to send Agustin's spit to the CDC and wait 2 months for the bacteria's genome to be fully sequenced, or to send it to the California State Lab, which did not have the capacity to sequence the entire genome, but did have a machine capable of searching for specific mutations. 2 months was too long, and so she sent the sample to the California State Lab. 2 days later, they called to say that Agustin Zeferino's TB had mutated in a way never before seen in the United States. The specific mutation, previously discovered only in the state of Oaxaca, had two terrifying traits. It was resistant to more than just one of the TB drugs, and it didn't reveal itself until the infected person was in the middle of treatment for ordinary TB. At some point in the 9 months of Zeferino's treatment, the bacteria inside him had made an error in its genetic code that allowed it to escape the drugs meant to kill it. The worst thing that you can do is treat with an inadequate regimen, said Charity. And that's exactly what I had been doing. The expression, "what doesn't kill you makes you stronger," actually isn't usually true for human beings. It is for bacteria, however. Inside Agustin Zeferino, the TB bacteria had evolved a greater resistance to any drugs used to treat it. Charity had to assume that anyone who lived or worked with Agustin had been infected with this same new deadly pathogen. She needed to track and test any number of Oaxacans who did not particularly want to be tracked or tested. One day, a public health nurse would turn up and find 18 members of the Zeferino family and residents in their tiny house. The next, they'd all have vanished. Charity asked the public health nurses to keep an eye out for cases and to alert her if any children with the last name of Zeferino turned up in the county clinic. Then one morning, she got a phone call from the public health clinic in Santa Maria. A baby boy with the last name Zeferino had just been diagnosed with failure to thrive. Failure to thrive was more a description than an understanding. Malnutrition could cause it, but other things could too, and TB was one of them. That day happened to be busy for Charity, too busy. She knew that babies manifested TB in particular ways, and that one of them was a failure to thrive. She didn't personally investigate, however. She asked the pediatrician to take an X-ray of the baby's chest and to call disease control if it showed abnormalities. The pediatrician had never followed up, and she hadn't pursued him. She didn't want to come across as pushy. She was, after all, a new face in the public health office. She wanted people to like her. A month later, she had another call about a baby boy in the ICU in a Santa Maria hospital. The nurses wanted to test the baby for TB. Charity realized instantly that it must be the same baby they'd mentioned to her a month earlier. The baby's TB test came back positive. She scrambled to figure out what had happened. She called the pediatrician and learned that after he'd sent the baby for a chest X-ray, but before the pictures had arrived, he'd taken a month-long vacation. His nurse had left the X-ray out for him to inspect upon his return. Charity ordered the images and now saw the TB. For most of the month, the X-ray had sat in a pile on the pediatrician's desk, and the baby had declined rapidly. When his parents finally appeared with him in the public health emergency room, he was inert. The final horror of the situation revealed itself when the hospital called the parents to inform them that their baby was brain dead. "We don't have a son," they said. The Oaxacan community, at least that part of it, encountered by the public health nurses in Santa Barbara County, rejected children with serious defects. They pretended that the child had never been born. Charity was informed that the little boy would live out his days in a medical orphanage. The event had knocked her sideways, scarred her. It taught her what it meant to be a public health officer. It meant that you never just let things slide. "I had thought that as a health officer, my reputation was supposed to be as the good cop," said Charity. "Not after that. After that, I was all about never, never letting that happen again." She confined Agustin to a room in the Villa Motel. In her office with the TB ventilation grates, she hung photographs of the children he'd infected. She notified the pediatricians of Santa Maria, instructing them to give skin tests and chest X-rays to any child who turned up with flu-like symptoms and whose parents were Mixtec speakers. She issued an order that every case of TB in Santa Barbara had to have its genome searched for the mutant gene. It popped up inside Agustin's brother and in Agustin's nieces and nephews. It popped up in people in the Oaxacan community who claimed they'd never heard of Agustin. The public health nurses would investigate and discover that not only had they heard of him, but they had spent time with him and that Agustin had broken out of quarantine. The genomic information revealed social relationships. "There were always surprises," said Charity. You think you know how the disease is traveling, but you don't. Charity had never heard of anyone using the genetic fingerprints of a pathogen to track its movements through a community. Now she saw what a powerful disease-fighting tool genomics might be in the right hands. Still, for the moment, it was being used mainly to reveal the many ways Agustin Zeferino was violating her order to quarantine. The number of his room at the Villa Motel in Santa Maria, 240, remained stuck years later in the heads of the public health nurses. They kept lists of what they'd found inside when they brought Agustin his meals and medicine. One day, it was a pair of high heels, another, the hooker to whom they belonged, another, the garbage from what had obviously been a huge party. Some days, they'd turn up and find that the patient had simply vanished. His mutation turned up in the prostitute, in his friends, and in more children named Zeferino. At one point, a single public health nurse in Santa Barbara County named Sandy Isaacs was treating 26 TB cases associated with Agustin Zeferino. Charity signed an order to have Agustin arrested and jailed. The jail kept him for a short spell, but then released him without explanation, though Charity guessed that the prison officials were frightened. "I could put him in jail, but I couldn't keep him there," she said. After trying and failing to confine Agustin Zeferino to a hospital handcuffed to a bed, she secured from a judge permission to strap a GPS monitor to his ankle, which was why, of an evening, she was able to track Agustin as he left his motel room and strolled down the street to a strip club named the Spearmint Rhino. "Note to self," said Charity. "Don't put the isolation motel next to a strip club." On August 11, 2014, a public health nurse arrived at the Villa Motel to give Agustin his medicine and found his room empty and his GPS band in the trash can. Charity issued a warrant for his arrest, then told the sheriff that he was easily the most dangerous person in Santa Barbara County. She issued a press release with Agustin's photo and ignoring warnings from state officials that she was courting a lawsuit for violating medical privacy laws, included information about his illness. The ensuing manhunt was unsuccessful. As they said in the disease control business, the patient was lost to follow up. Where Agustin wound up, likely in Mexico, was obviously important. Where he had stopped along the way was equally so. He had TB in his lungs with a mutation never found inside the United States. Charity thought that the state needed to sequence the genome of the bacteria in every TB case they found. Tuberculosis had a gift for hiding. If you breathed it in, one of two things happened. It gave you active TB or went dormant. If it goes dormant, you might never know you had it, but you'll also be walking around with a ticking bomb inside you, as there is a 10% chance that at some point in your life, it will reactivate. It might take 2 years or 10, but the multi-drug-resistant mutation would reappear. And the surest way to prevent it from killing people was by hunting the genes. "You are going to find crumb trails all the way down to Mexico," Charity told people inside California's Department of Public Health. But the state health department didn't have the money to spare. "It's bonkers," said Charity. "I guarantee you that we will have cases out there that will be a perfect match. And we won't find them because we don't have the resources." One measure of poverty is how little you have. Another is how difficult you find it to take advantage of what others try to give you. Only a tiny handful of local public health offices had the interest in or the ability to exploit the most powerful tool that the Chan Zuckerberg BioHub was trying to give them for free. "They didn't know how to ask for things," said Priscilla Chan, because they'd never gotten anything. Right from the start, the nonprofit BioHub was able to do more for local public health offices than any for-profit lab did. The commercial labs were set up to take in test tubes containing human genetic material and spit out a simple answer, positive or negative. They weren't set up to sequence the genome of the virus in the positive specimens. And the genomics was the critical game within the game. Viruses mutate, which is to say that they make errors in their genetic code when they replicate. Different viruses make errors at different rates. A perfectly stable virus, that is, a virus that does not mutate, would be impossible to track. The virus in every infected person would have precisely the same genetic code. Just by inspecting those codes, you would not be able to say who gave the virus to whom. For instance, herpes mutates so slowly, it's hard to divine how it has traveled from the genetic code alone. At the other extreme, when a virus mutates too quickly, its movements are equally impossible to follow. The viruses that cause the common cold, for example, they mutate so rapidly that, inside of a single human being, they replace their entire genome and escape the defenses created by any vaccine. A fast-mutating virus is as untraceable as a burglar who leaves behind billions of different fingerprints. From the point of view of a virus hunter, COVID-19 sits in a sweet spot. It mutates very reliably every one or two times it transmits from person to person. If I catch the bug from you, the genomes of our viruses will either be exactly the same or they will differ by a single mutation. Just by watching these changes, you can track the virus's journey through a community. By 2020, it was not just possible but practical to analyze huge numbers of viral genomes. Back in 2003, Joe had spent a small fortune to sequence a piece of the original SARS virus's genome, but the cost of genomic sequencing had fallen exponentially. What cost me $10,000 to do in 2001 now costs a penny, said Joe. In late April 2020, the underemployed BioHub COVID lab teamed with UCSF researchers to test everyone who either lived or worked in a four-square block area of San Francisco's Mission District. The area formed a tract in the U.S. Census, number 022901, of special interest to a virus hunter, as it was less a typical American community than aspects of many different American communities. It had charming Victorian houses, less charming housing developments, and densely packed brutalist apartment buildings. It had people living on the streets. It had upper-middle-class people and really poor people. It had teleworkers and construction workers. It had four churches, a street of retail shops, and a park. It held a big working-class Latino population, and among them, like chips in a cookie, were lots of hipsters and tech bros. It was as if someone had thrown the pieces to seven different puzzles into one box. It wasn't clear that the pieces were happy about this. The lower floor windows of almost every building were barred. Signs everywhere told strangers to keep out, and murals and graffiti had unkind words for the ICE police. Men without masks walked dogs without collars or leashes, and both eyed you a bit as you passed them on the street. Just banging on the doors had been an eye-opener. One three-bedroom apartment that was meant to be housing five people contained 40 who were sleeping in shifts around the clock. In the end, roughly 3,000 of the 4,087 official residents showed up to be tested over 4 days in late April 2020. A bit more than 6% of the Latino residents turned out to be infected by COVID. Most with high loads of the virus, though many had no symptoms. There were patterns in the test results. For example, the richer the person, the less likely he was to be infected. Latinos were only 44% of the study, but 95% of the positives. Of the 981 white people tested, zero were positive. The big takeaways seemed to be what everyone was just then figuring out. The virus was disproportionately attacking poor people of color, unable to work from home, and lots of infectious people were walking around without a clue about their condition. To Joe DeRisi, however, none of those was the biggest takeaway. The biggest takeaway was the chart on page 264. The chart was a simplified snapshot of the genetic relationships of all the virus found in the 4-square block area of San Francisco in late April 2020. You had to stare at it a bit to see the implications, and even then you sort of needed Joe's help. But look hard enough and you'd see, from the virus's point of view, a terrifying new weapon. In all of history, we've never had a really clear picture of the spread of a virus, said Joe. That just changed. The starting point in the chart is not the San Francisco neighborhood, but Wuhan, where the virus originated in December 2019. The original genome before it changes. Joe liked to think of the subsequent mutations as errors in a medieval manuscript being copied by monks. The mistakes were random, but could be incredibly revealing. Drop in on any cluster of figures in the chart, and you begin to see stuff that's impossible to see in any other way. The household we'll call example one, for instance. Three people in the same household were infected with the same virus. That is, the genomes of their viruses were identical. No big news there. One of them likely gave it to the others. The news is how it entered the household, likely from the mission resident on the same vertical line. He has the exact same virus, but contracted it earlier, which is why he has the antibodies and they do not. The advanced age of his infection is conveyed on the chart by the line beneath his feet. The people he may have infected are not just above him, but also to the right of him. This same resident who likely infected the household may have also infected two workers who don't even live in the mission, said Joe, pointing to another household of workers, one step to the right of those residents. It's possible there is one degree of separation between them, that he gave it to someone who gave it to them, but no more than that. Without the genomic information, you might never have any idea that these people had any sort of relationship at all. Even if a test had identified the person who infected the household and that person were questioned by teams of contact tracers, the connection with the household might never have been made. The person might not even be aware of the connection or might know it and want to hide it. Once we know that these people must have some social connection, the question becomes, what is it? Do they ride the same bus? Are they having an affair? Do their kids play together? There are all kinds of rumors, said Joe. Kids. Are kids the hidden vector? Or can you get it from a handrail? Those guys sitting along the wall beside the park, are they the problem? Or is it the guys playing cards in the park? Just then, in early April 2020, it was growing clear to a lot of people at once that the coronavirus did not spread in an orderly way. Just as 10% of the people in any company do 90% of the work, some small number of people with the virus were responsible for some big number of cases. The human being with the oldest infection in example 2 has a gift for doing more than his share. He likely infected not only the household above him, but another mission worker, and might even be responsible for the two small clusters to the right of him. The genomic information reveals the urgency of getting him off the streets, but it also might lead you, more generally, to whatever he might be doing to spread the disease. All the other little clusters on the charts are of people who are interconnected in ways that might never have been revealed without the genomic information. It's amazing that all these stories fall into place, said Joe, as he scrolled through that first chart they'd created. Science was now able to transform a novel coronavirus into little works of narrative nonfiction. Around the same time as the mission study, up in Humboldt County, a meth dealer had tested positive for COVID-19. The public health nurses had gotten to him soon after he'd been infected, and he agreed to isolate himself. The nurses suspected he was still sneaking out at night, and suspected it even more when a friend of his became infected. That friend lived with his son and daughter-in-law, who worked at Alder Bay Assisted Living in Eureka. The daughter-in-law had no symptoms, but within a week, more than a dozen Alder Bay staff members and residents had been infected. 4 died. The public health nurses could not see the chain of events. Then they received the genome sequencing from the biohub, and it showed that everyone in Alder Bay had been infected by the daughter-in-law, and that her virus had come from her father-in-law, and that his virus had come from the meth dealer. "It's like the DNA evidence in a crime," said a Humboldt County public health nurse named Erica Dykhouse. "When we got it, we said, 'We're not crazy. We're not crazy.'" At the heart of any defense against the virus was the creation of safe, defensible spaces. Nursing homes, schools, offices, apartment buildings, neighborhoods. The genomics allowed you to see whether the virus was transmitting within your safe space, and so the ways that your safe space was not safe. It let you see when and how the virus had infiltrated the safe space, and alerted you to the need to rethink your border control. The distinction between internal transmission and invasion was critical to a society that wanted to remain open. Soon after the mission study, for example, a pair of workers at a fish packing plant in rural California came down with the symptoms of COVID-19. The biohub processed their tests and found that both workers had the virus. In an age not all that distant from our own, the fish packing plant, which believed it had taken the measures necessary to keep its workers safe, would have been forced to close. It would have had to assume that one of the workers infected the other on the job. But the biohub sequenced the viruses from the two infected workers and discovered that they were genetically very far apart. The workers had contracted the virus independently, outside of work. The fish packing plant could stay open, and all its workers could keep their jobs. In late January 2021, the biohub and UCSF research team returned to the same 4-square block area in the mission. This time, a bit more than 1,000 would test positive for COVID-19. One would have a mutation never before seen in the United States. It had been detected only in Brazil in October 2020, after a 37-year-old female healthcare worker was reinfected. The mutation had allowed the virus to escape the antibodies her immune system had produced during its first battle with COVID-19. A strain of the virus that escaped antibodies might also evade a vaccine. "It's a change in a single chemical," said Joe, "and evolution found it. Evolution would find other chemicals in other strains, especially after people received a vaccine and the virus came under pressure to escape it." It was not possible for a vaccine maker or society to adapt to an evolving virus without genomic information. And yet nearly a year into the pandemic, in February 2021, the number of genomes being sequenced in the United States was trivial. Less than 1/3 of 1% of the virus in people who tested positive. The UK was by then sequencing 10% of its positives. Denmark had set a goal of sequencing all of them. The United States was sequencing fewer of its genomes than any other industrialized country. And the only reason it was sequencing as many as it was is that a bunch of nonprofits had stepped in to do it haphazardly for free. In the whole of the pandemic's first year, the tiny biohub had been responsible for nearly half of all the genomic sequencing in California, and more than 5% in the United States. Joe had been shocked by just how slow the society was to realize what science might do for it. It was as if tanks had been invented before the Civil War and the generals couldn't figure out their purpose. "Our federal government should be doing this in a coordinated way," he said. "At the very least, our state government should be doing this. That's what you would do in a rational society. But the system is broken. It's so broken." Looking back on that first year of the pandemic, Joe was able to pinpoint when he felt the last flicker of hope he had in that system. It had occurred on the afternoon of April 29th, 2020, when he'd joined a hopeful Zoom call between Priscilla Chan and the state of California. Priscilla couldn't understand why local health officers across the resource-starved public health system weren't using the biohub to test for the virus and track it. "I sort of felt like I was speaking out of turn," she said, "but you could already tell that the variants were going to be a problem." Joe was like, "Look, you can see them, and you can see where they come from." She'd written to Mark Galley, California's Secretary of Health and Human Services, and asked for the meeting. Galley had replied with enthusiasm and scheduled it. "I was thirsting for leadership to come down from on high," said Joe. "I thought surely the state would have some overall strategy to better direct us."